We'd like to thank our patrons for supporting this episode of Registry Matters.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 126 of Registry Matters. How the hot in hell are you, Larry?
Fantastic. You're looking really good on that cam.
Uh-oh. You figured it out?
It's pretty nice.
I am trying something new.
The picture of me looks pretty, it's amazingly accurate.
Yeah, it's a recent photo. I promise. It's a recent photo. At the last conference, I think I got a picture of you, and that's what is being that's what's being used for representation of you.
Well, it's so close that I think it's you couldn't have done any better.
Well, photos don't lie. I mean, it did add maybe 10 or so pounds to you. That's a pretty typical complaint about photos, is they make you look about 10 pounds fatter.
So, well, all right.
Your hair's a little long, though. You must have some COVID hair going on for this photo that's being used.
Yeah, I reckon I do.
Uh-oh. You're not using any of those black market services, are you?
I got to remember not to say those type of words because the transcriptionist has trouble trying to figure out how to spell reckon.
Oh, yes, because he might spell W-R-E-C-K. What? Reckon? Like
That's
actually
correct.
Breaking stuff?
We've got to make it very simple for the transcriber.
Now, tell me, why are we recording like 7 hours early?
Well, because the heat is getting warmer and warmer in this office, and I'd like to be out of here before it hits 90. It's in the 80s now.
Do you not know how to turn on the thermostat?
I'm pretty sure I know how to turn it on. It's inoperable at the moment.
Are we going to cover 700 articles from COVID-related things tonight?
Hopefully not, but we've got a few.
Okay. We're trying. I really do think that there's a certain amount of COVID fatigue with, you know, all you hear is about how many people have died. All you hear is about, it's just all the problems. And I'm trying as best as I can to avoid doing COVID articles. If we can. I mean, if they're relevant, they're relevant. But if they're not, like, can we drop them?
Well, we've dropped about 10 already.
Yes, we did. So are you ready to begin with this first one that I think you would classify this one as funny?
I think I would.
All right. Well, this one, first one comes from Tech Dirt. Ninth Circuit says man can't sue officers who destroyed his home to capture an unarmed homeless man. Larry, I got a question. Unarmed? The guy was actually like, he didn't have his upper appendages?
Well, he was not, he didn't have a weapon, but he indicated to the police he did have a weapon. And as the case unfolded, when he finally was taken into custody, he didn't have a weapon. But they responded as if he did have a weapon.
They responded as if he was like Osama bin Laden and he was hiding in the bunker or something. I mean, they responded with 55 vehicles, including a crisis response team motorhome and two helicopters. An unarmed homeless guy that seems a little above what would be necessary. What's the word that you use? Like, isn't there a word that we should use? Appropriate response. This is an unarmed homeless guy. Like, we need 55 vehicles.
But again, the unarmed was not discovered until after the apprehension. He had told the police that he was armed.
Oh.
So they're operating on that premise that they were dealing with an armed person. Now, I'm not justifying the response. I think it was still probably excessive. But the Fresno Sheriff's Department and the Clovis PD, they were operating under the belief that he was armed at the time. But 55 vehicles and two SWAT teams does seem a bit much.
I know that we're going to say that if we don't want them to use these things, then we shouldn't give them to them. I'm thinking of, you probably didn't see the movie called The Hurt Locker, but it was about a bomb disposal guy over in Baghdad, Afghanistan, somewhere over in the Middle East. And the suit that he puts on to go dispose of a bomb, the suit is designed for him to take a bomb blow directly to the face. And I'm thinking that we could have suited somebody up in a full suit of this, and he could walk in and go, I'm here to assess the situation. I could figure out that he doesn't have a weapon, and then we could respond appropriately and just go in there with two guys or, you know, five people and not tear down the place, maybe?
Probably so. I've always believed that if you can contain a perimeter around a crisis situation, that time works in most instances in your favor, because if there's only one person, the police agencies will have a multiple. They can do shift rotations, and time will eventually exhaust the person, which as they fatigue, they're either more willing to talk, surrender, or it's more likely that you can catch them off guard and do an arrest and a disable, incapacitate them, I think is the word I'm looking for. But you can incapacitate the suspect. But again, the question in this case was whether or not that the police have immunity for their behavior, and did they violate they used the vehicle 1983 under 42 United States Code Section 1983, Civil Rights. They used that section, and they have a pretty high standard to show that there was some willful disregarding of a person's constitutional rights. That precedent has to be clearly established, and they weren't able to meet that high hurdle because law enforcement has provided broad latitude in what deployment of force they use to bring a crisis under control, and they were found to be immune from the action by on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, which I know it's gotten more conservative since Trump has named several judges, but it's supposed to be one of the more liberal circuits still, and they deferred to the police. Now, we don't know the three judges on the panel, which, you know, who appointed them. I didn't get that far into analyzing it, but he just didn't, you know, the damage was unfortunate, but the police are not responsible for the things that they damage when they're performing their official duties.
And I don't think we've described the damage done was that they did $150,000 of damage. Five rooms were tear gassed, four doors and seven windows were destroyed, along with 90 feet of fencing that was rolled over by SWAT vehicles. I don't think vehicles come 90 feet wide, even under the worst of circumstances or best of circumstances. Like, your car is 6 feet wide, maybe? So how did they do 90 feet of damage to the fence? Couldn't they have made their way through it and then followed the car in front of them?
They probably wanted they wanted that sight barrier open, I'm guessing. This is all a conjecture here, but I'm guessing that law enforcement tends to be officer safety's first, and those other factors are extraneous, but officer safety, clear sight lines, and making sure that they have a containment perimeter. Now, not knowing the layout of it, perhaps maybe that wall would have served as a better containment barrier than knocking
it
down.
Right.
But
yeah, you would see the guy, and then he would have to, you know, unless it's like a 2 foot high fence and he just steps over it. But, you know, assuming that the guy would flee and then he would have to entertain the obstacle, like, that would be a barrier for the person to go by.
Well, I pulled the decision. It was very brief, and it's not precedential. It's not published. But then there was a reference to a case out of the Tenth Circuit that was similar in a city in Colorado, and they did extensive damage to a home. Person had called the police, and they were trying to apprehend a suspect, and the Tenth Circuit did a much deeper analysis, and that complaint was on the takings clause of the U.S. Constitution, and the Tenth Circuit resoundingly said that the taking clause was not an issue because the takings clause has to do with compensation, due process, and compensation for your property that's converted to public use, and they said that the police didn't convert the property to public use; they merely did what they needed to do to extract a felon. And therefore, the takings clause didn't apply. And I thought that it bears some relevance to the present circumstances with COVID-19, because I predict there will be, and I'm not alone in my predictions, there's been many people predict that there's going to be a plethora of litigation. But one of the things is going to be the takings clause. Businesses that have been shut down, losing many, many thousands and hundreds of thousands, and maybe even millions of dollars, depending on the size of the business, they're going to come in and allege that the government took from them. And this is going to be the comparison, because if you do the same if you use the Tenth Circuit precedent, so if anybody were to bring this claim to me and ask me to screen it, I would say, well, the case law is not very favorable to you in the Tenth Circuit, because even though you have had your life wrecked and your business destroyed, it's not like the government went into your business and took it over and started operating it and exploiting the profits. They have just simply shut it down. So they have not, in the literal sense, and I know we believe in strict interpretation, that has not been converted to something for the public good. It's just simply, you've not been allowed to use it. And we're going to have this deluge of litigation, and it's going to be very fascinating for legal junkies like me to to see how this unfolds and what the courts say in terms of whether the government is liable for any of the damage that's been done.
So that I can come back and say you were wrong later or right later? Did you just semi-predict that it's not favorable for some business saying you shut me down for X amount of months and I am going to sue the government for X told dollars, and you don't think that that would win because of precedent?
Well, if they were going to use the takings clause as the basis supporting their claim, and if they were in the Tenth Circuit, because I just read that decision before we started recording. So if they came to me with a theory and said, I believe the government has violated the takings clause of the Constitution, I would say, really? Have you looked at the Tenth Circuit case law of this? Well, no, I haven't. And I'd say, well, I have. And I'd say, what did the government take from you? And they would say, well, they didn't let me operate my business. I would say, but the taking clause has been interpreted to be converting something to the public good without compensation, without due process. You still own your property, so it hasn't been taken from you. It was not used for the public good. It would be different if they came in and said, we're taking this facility from you. We need it for the public good. We're going to operate it for the next 90 days. We need housing. Your hotel has just become a hospital ward.
Yes.
Then you would, I think you would have something under the takings clause. But if they just simply say your hotel can only operate at 25% capacity, that's an order for the public good. Nothing has been taken from you, and at least in the Tenth Circuit's interpretation of the takings clause. I would tell you that I think your case is not going to be very strong if that's your sole theory for winning, that you probably won't get very far in this circuit.
Well, there you go. Larry has said it. Mark the date that we can either applaud you or condemn you.
All righty.
How about over at NPR? Voting rights for hundreds of thousands of felons at stake in Florida trial. This is related to the amendment, I believe, from the 18 election where Florida voted against or to repeal the Fourth Amendment that prevented people with convictions from voting. Yet then, not long after that, the Republican-controlled legislature put in barriers to say you can't vote unless you've paid all money, but it's a challenge for people to figure out how much they owe and to whom and how to pay it and all that stuff. So they're just sort of like stuck in this murky rabbit hole.
Well, the Amendment 4 that passed overwhelmingly, I don't remember the margin, but our super patron could probably tell us, it restored the right upon completion of all obligations. But the voters voted on language was all obligations, I believe it was the language. And the lawsuit is because the legislature, and we're not picking on Republicans, that just happens to be who is in control of the state of Florida. But the all terms is actually in the article rather than all obligations, all terms, they defined that language to mean any civil levies, you know, any restitution beyond just serving your probation and parole. Now, we don't know when people say, well, what's the court going to decide? We don't know. What did the voter visualize in Florida? What were they led to believe that we were voting for? Were they voting that you could have your right restored when you had paid every bit of restitution and case-related cost? Or were they voting to make you whole once you had served your prison time and any post-prison supervision? What did that amendment mean to the average voter? Because the language says all terms. What does all terms mean?
How would you even, that seems like post, how would you even determine? You could find that information out prior to, but then all the waters would be muddied at this point. You couldn't go back and ask. I don't think you could get honest answers, because with all the reporting that would have been done up to this point, people would have their opinions altered pro or against, just in light of all the hoopla about it.
Well, this is going to come down to a judicial interpretation, and we're going to have the Scalia model, which is going to go straight to the letter of what does the word mean? What do all terms mean? Scalia would say, well, the lawmakers are very smart people, and they said all terms. And I look at your J&S, your judgment sentence, and one of the terms of your sentence was that you pay restitution. So to me, it's cut and dry. It's black and white. If I'm a Scalia, that if you go strictly by the text, if you're a textualist, if you go to that craziness that people that believe that purpose is what you should look at. If you look at what does Scalia call that purposivism? If you look at that, well, what did the voters think they were voting on? I have no idea. I wasn't in Florida. I'm sure there was a lot of advertising, a lot of promotion, you know, to vote in favor of Amendment 4. I don't know what the debate was on the floor of the Senate and the House when they were passing this and sending it on to the voters, because I'm imagining it, like if it's similar to our state, the amendment has to get passed the legislature and then it's presented to the voters. It doesn't have to be signed by the governor, but I'm assuming that it's very similar. Well, what did the voters intend to do if you're a purposivist? And I just don't know how this is going to play out, because all terms, if you take it literally, that was a term, wasn't it?
Yes.
All right. Well, have you paid your fine, Andy?
I would think that would be one of the terms of your sentence.
Okay. Well, then why are we even having this discussion when I look at your list of terms and you had to pay $1,000 in restitution, you had to pay a victim impact fee, you had to do this and that. And I see a whole bunch of terms. You served your time. You did that. But I see some terms that are incomplete. So I don't know what we're having this discussion for.
Could it be that you have unpaid parking tickets? And maybe that doesn't cross the threshold. But could you could have fines from other felonies that you've already served your time and all that stuff. And then this one is still that those things from 10, 20, 30 years ago are holding you up from being able to vote now.
That's correct. If you have any outstanding terms that are unsatisfied under this Amendment 4, the way I understand it, you're not going to be able to vote until the legislature said that all terms, in our opinion, means this. Now, if the people are so righteously indignant about that because it passed the citizenry by a significant margin, the people don't have to accept this interpretation by their legislature. They could register complete resentment at them at the polls this November, couldn't they?
I would think so, and they could hire a whole new staff of legislators to put forth that says, hey, if you've done your prison term or your supervision term, then you can then go vote, be damned the monies.
Well, that's what we're going to do, what's going to come out of this case, and there's a lot of states looking at it, according to the article.
Very well, sir. Very well. Then we should move over to an article from Reason Magazine. It says, condemned to death by a split jury in Florida. We just talked about something about this, and I thought that death sentences were all unanimous, and this confused me in them talking about not unanimous sentences in other states.
That's why I put it in here. I knew exactly that this is where this is going to go, because the guilt or innocence has to be determined unanimously. And then you proceed in a capital case to the sentencing phase. And in some of these particular southern states, not just southern, but particular southern states, they allow the jury to make a recommendation that the judge is likely to follow. In some cases, they actually allow the jury to impose it. But in Florida, if the jury is, in terms of the guilt has already been decided that they committed the act, then if 10 of 12 agree that the death penalty is appropriate, that's what's imposed. So you get a punishment that's non-unanimous, but the guilt or innocence is unanimous. Unlike in Louisiana and Oregon, where the verdict itself was non-unanimous in terms of your guilt or innocence.
Can I, to word it in my own stupid terms, so you could be found guilty by less than a unanimous jury, but then the court imposes a death sentence on you?
No. The decision on your guilt or innocence has to be unanimous in Florida.
All right.
But then we proceed to punishment.
Okay.
The jury decides, what do we want, life in prison or do we want the death penalty? And if 10 of the 12 jurors agree that the death penalty is appropriate, that's enough on the punishment. But all of them had to agree that you were guilty of the murder.
Oh, so the jury gets to make two decisions about yes. innocence or guilt, and then what level punishment. Of punishment?
Yes, and in some states, the jury recommends it. In some states, they actually impose it. In Florida, apparently, the jury is the sentencing on these cases. Like in Arkansas, the jury recommends, and the judge often, almost always, follows that recommendation. But this is only on the punishment phase. So you go to death row without a unanimous decision of the jury, as long as 10 of 12 agree.
Okay, again, back to my stupid brain, my uninformed brain. Like, innocence or guilt is lesser than sentencing someone to death. It would seem that we would have a higher bar for that level of finality. It would seem.
But you're confusing the issue. The jury has to be unanimous on whether or not you committed the act.
Right.
So yeah, the state has
to get that.
The state has to prove out beyond reasonable doubt that you're a murderer.
But then they could be 10 of the 12 could say, yes, nuke them, and that's enough to get nuked. That's bizarre to me.
So, well, that's what Florida decided to do after the Supreme Court declared their death penalty unconstitutional. So they came back and they fixed it.
Wow. Hey, go Florida. They did something right finally?
Well, I don't know if they did it right. Depends on if you believe in non-unanimous verdicts. I would prefer if someone's going to get the death penalty. I'd prefer there not be a death penalty, but I'd prefer that everybody agree.
I would. But, that's sort of where I was going with that. That like for that level of finality to make sure that everybody's on board with that idea that should be, that's a heavy burden. That's a heavy toll to impose on someone.
So, but yes, that's what happens.
Huh. Well, we should take up this article. It comes from Patch.com, which is always our favorite publication source during the Halloween season, because they're the ones that are posting all the articles, the hate articles about registrants and PFRs, people forced to register around the Halloween holiday, which isn't a holiday. But this is a modified sex offender registration system. At first blush, this seems like one of the things that we've been asking for. This is an automated way, because of COVID, that people can't go in to do the registration, that this might be an avenue for you to do your registration without being physically present, that you could do update your residence, maybe update a photo, and so forth. Did you read it the same way?
I did, but what's going to happen is it's going to have a monetary component attached to it, as everything does. All this great technology comes with money attached to it, and for the convenience of being able to go to the kiosk, you're going to have to pay. Just about bet you.
Oh, what do you bet? we get a convenience checkout fee.
Yes, I'm figuring that all this is driven. This is your great capitalist system figuring out a new way to extract money.
They've been in business since the early 2000s. I went and looked up like their about page, and their whole purpose is to monetize the registry system.
Well, absolutely. They monetize the government's paid them gobs of money for what they're already doing.
Do you happen to know how many states use Offender Watch as the like the online reporting, like to go look up somebody's address in your neighborhood? Do you happen to know how many states?
I think it's more than the majority. I don't know. I think
really?
Last heard over 30.
It's yours. It's not mine.
So
anyway, so this would allow you to, I think, put something of an app on your phone to do your update, which then you think might come with, hey, if you want to do your update here, you could do it, pay us $29.95 to update your status instead of going into visit the popo.
That's what I'm predicting. I base that on vehicle registration. All the things that our state does, what we call the Motor Vehicle Division, most people call it the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles, but we don't have a department, we have a division, which is a part of Taxation and Revenue Department. And the Motor Vehicle Division is privatized. We have both state-operated MVD and we have private MVD Express. And if you want the convenience of being able to go and be treated with dignity and respect and not have to wait in line and deal with those awful government bureaucrats, you can pay a transaction fee. And I think last time I tried, it was around $16 in addition to the, you know, to the, so if your license is going to cost you $16, for example, you'd pay the $16.95. Fee to the private provider. Now, I found it to be, last time I went in, I was going to renew my driver's license at MVD Express for the very reasons I just said. And I went in and they told me that I did not qualify with my vision, but I just had a visual exam and I just had a brand new pair of glasses. And they told me at MVD Express that I did not qualify because I was not able to read from both eyes, but you're not required to. And I told them, you cannot show me anywhere in the motor vehicle code that you're required to have binocular vision. You're not even required to have a pilot's license, much less to drive a motor vehicle. And I said, I've been licensed for all these decades. And you people are telling me that I have to have binocular view. That's right. I said, show it to me in the code. Well, nobody could show it to me in the code. So I finally left and I went to the state operated office and I got my number and I said, before I sit and wait, do you people understand whether or not I have to have binocular vision to get renewed my license? They said, yes, we do. And I said, so you understand that if I only have one-eyed vision, you can actually issue me a license before I sit here and wait? And they said, yes, of course. And I said, okay. So I waited. So sometimes the private company doesn't know best, but anyway.
Well, after we've taken that little detour, I'm trying to, if you have a job where your employer is not flexible, maybe they have a tight schedule of some sort, maybe you're a truck driver of some sort, you're on the road, maybe traveling, whatever, this could be, you know, a saving element for you. And as a convenience fee, maybe it's a, you know, maybe it's a $20 fee, like you described, $16-$17. But that could be a huge burden for someone. Now they have to take a day off from work and now potentially miss that whole days of pay. That would be a pain in the ass.
Well, that's why I brought the point up. If I'm guessing right, this is going to turn into something where they will agree Offender Watch will provide the kiosk, so the state doesn't have to invest any money. And all we ask is that we just be compensated for our technology, which is a transactional fee. And people can decide, they can go to the sheriff's office and they can wait in line and they can sit and get COVID-19 and they can be fingerprinted, or they can come use this nice thing and put their finger on the screen and it'll read their thumb or their fingerprint, and we can have them out in a blast, and there's no reason why they shouldn't pay. That's where I think this is potentially going to head.
I'm with you. Wow.
And people will pay.
I can see it. If instead of going and being manhandled, if I can just talk to a computer, Larry, I would pick talk to a computer over being manhandled any day of the week.
And how much would you pay for that service? Because we know law enforcement's listening, so we can get some idea of what to put the fee at. What would you be willing to pay
to go talk to $7.95.
That's it. So if it's $8.95, you won't pay it.
I would probably, if it's less than 20, I would most likely just do that. But more, then I would have to start having a conversation with myself about it. And I would say, self, let me ask you a question. But if it were like 50, now I'd probably go get manhandled. But that also has a lot to do with that my process here has been super stress-free, in my opinion. Like, the individual that does it is, you know, I don't know if the bedside manner is the right term, but he is professional. He is not, you know, he's not like a drill sergeant telling you to get down on the floor and do push-ups all the time. He's a cordial individual, and I don't have a stressful situation when I do it, beyond the stress of having the day to go do it.
Well, you're fortunate. There's so many that have very stressful encounters, and they are told to do things that the law doesn't require.
Right.
And in fact, we were looking at your county just north of Atlanta, Northwest Cobb County, that where they're inventing a lot of requirements
and being sued on behalf of such things. Right.
Well, we're working on that. We're trying to put together the right claims and cause of action. I really don't like losing litigation. I have this thing about you have to select carefully, and you have to make sure you have solid case law on your side, and you pick the right plaintiffs, and you go into it with the intent of winning. And of course, you can't win them all, and no one wins them all, but except for the state, they do win most all of them when they prosecute people. But when you're doing civil rights litigation, you're not going to win them all. But you need to win the majority of them. You can't stay in business because it's very expensive, and your donors won't support you if you continually lose litigation.
That might not always be true, Larry. I'm not going to go into who I might be referring to, but that might not always be true.
All righty then.
Over at mynewsla.com, buyers of $1 million Glendale home say they weren't there's a missing word in this title. They weren't informed of a sex offender living next door. So here's this Glendale couple suing because they bought $1 million home that had quote unquote substantial defects, and also that a RSO PFR lived next door. I have spoken at length with a friend of mine that's a realtor, and that person is not required to divulge anything about crime statistics in the neighborhood, about any of the professions of people living nearby, and especially nothing about any PFRs living next door or within 1,000 feet or in the state. It's not on the list. It would introduce personal biases. It would introduce, their opinion into your decision to buy a house. Leave it. It's on you to go do those due diligence things and finding out what the crime rate is in your neighborhood and whatnot.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I suspect this claim is not going to go all that far if the if you've got an online registry, and I think California's is. I think all the people except maybe juvenile are on the public registry. If you're going to buy a home and that's a factor for you, it would be like any other research as you described, the crime statistics, the schools. Now, most realtors will list the schools, you know, the attendance boundaries. They'll tell you what your designated school would be. But if you want to know if there's
an opinion,
but if you want to know if there's a, well, wouldn't the PFR be a fact also?
Yeah, I suppose. But
I think that if we have a public registry, it would behoove you, if that's a factor for you, to do that research to figure that out. And now what will happen is that the lawsuit will probably get tossed. Then the person will go to a lawmaker in the assembly in California and say, pass a bill that requires this. And everybody will be put in a position where they can't vote against it. Because how can you vote against this disclosure? I put my whole life savings into this and come to find out, look what was next door.
About $1 million home, man. I don't think that that's their life savings. If they got that high to get a home, somebody's making some pretty decent cash at that point.
So, but yeah, but it's
how do you think that because California, I don't want to use the term nanny state, but more of a nanny state, they may have this on their books?
Well, it didn't say that in the article. It didn't say that there was a requirement to disclose that.
Yeah. I was just wondering if possibly, I mean, this could be something, a blindside that me being over in Redville, that's being Blueville, that maybe they have a little bit more of a nanny situation and the realtors are required to go do it.
Well, if they're not, they're going to soon have that introduced in the California Assembly.
Well, then pontificate for me, Mr. Lobbyist person, that how would a realtor protect themselves in that situation that they did a search a week before closing and then a PFR moves in next, like they're supposed to continually update until the second that they're signing the piece of paper. They close the documents like 2 or 3 days before. So like you have to have everything updated prior to that, or else now the realtor and the realtor company is liable for it.
Well, I think you would do it kind of like you do when you cite to a website when you're doing a briefing. You put last visited on the we put the link and then we put last visited because stories get updated. And I think you would say that on your disclosure that a search had been done on the California Sex Offender Registration website. And as of this date, there was nobody within this radius, I think is what you would do. And then, but there's no guarantee that there won't be anybody with that radius very shortly thereafter.
Yeah. Cause there's even a delay in the reporting side of it that, you know, new person comes out of prison and goes to move in with mom and them. And all of, you know, how long does it take before the website gets updated? Maybe it's a week, maybe it's 48 hours, maybe it's 2 weeks. And in that window, you did your checks and now you've got that gap, that window. It seems almost impossible to actually keep up with.
It would be something where I would not be in favor of it, but if such a piece of legislation is introduced, it's going to be hard to vote against it.
Mm. So you have to kill it in committee. Are we back to that?
That's where we are. If it makes it out of committee, it's going to be hard to kill this thing on the floor. Can you imagine the vilification you would take for voting against alerting families that there was a PFR in their neighborhood?
Very much so. Very much so. All right. Well, I found a video from, we've covered the individual. God, I think we covered a video like a year ago, and it's just this dude that like moved to Germany and he periodically puts out videos. He seems to be doing it a little bit more. And one showed up dated today about language levels and certifications. And by all means, please go watch it. It's just shy of 20 minutes long. I find the individual super interesting and the idea of just moving away from all this registry bullshit. Like just, hey, look, it happened long enough ago that perhaps they don't care. If that narrative is true, I don't know how to validate that other than hearing his testimonial. But I have a little clip, and after you give me your feedback, initial thoughts on it, I will play it. And I just have about a minute or so clip of something he says at the end that doesn't just apply to this, but applies to anything that we are going to talk about trying to make life better for people. But before I play that, do you have any initial thoughts?
Well, you remember when we played him the last time, I said that his experience with the German police, I would not be ready to say that that's what every foreign national would encounter with the German immigration customs or whatever they call their equivalent. So I would say the same thing again, that this individual may not be representative of what the nation.
Your mileage may vary.
Yes, and past performance may not indicate future results. So,
that sounds like a stock tip.
That's what they say, yep.
All right, so I got this little clip. It's a little over a minute long to play.
I tell you all the time, in every video that I have, I always make it a point to say, if you're not happy with your life, if you're not happy with your situation, do something about it. And I mean it, but it's on you to do it. Nobody's going to do it for you. If you just wait for your circumstances to change, you're going to be waiting an awfully long time. So people ask me often, what's the first thing I should do? What's the first step I should take if I'm thinking about moving to Europe? This is the first step you should take. You should start thinking about, where would I like to live in Europe? Where do I think I'd fit in? Let's say that it's France. At that point, what you need to do is you need to start learning French, but you need to start learning it like you mean it. And let's say you have a year left on your probation. Let's say you have 2 years left of parole. You spend that time devoted to getting the basics of your language. Now, granted, you're going to learn that language much, much better once you're in country. But this is a concrete step that you can take today. This is something that you can begin today. And you can start taking back control of your life. Because I understand that your freedom, your physical freedom, is restricted by the sex offender registry or parole officer or your conditions of probation. I understand that. But nobody's going to stop you from studying a language. And this is something that you can do now. So stop being a victim of your circumstances and start being a survivor. Start looking for solutions to your problems. This is a distinct step forward that you can do right now. And I highly encourage you to do it, if you are considering moving to Europe. So
my main emphasis behind this is, you could transpose out of there anything about language and move into Germany. But if you want to change your situation, it is on you to go figure out things that you can do to improve your situation. And while I know that it's crushing all that comes down the pike with the registry, there are things that you, me, we can do to make things better for our own personal lives, and things that we can make better for us as a community of PFR's lives.
I figured that was why you zeroed in on that segment, and I agree that that what we sit back and there's an apathy of wanting to be saved. This is so wrong that someone should save me, and the someone is you.
Right.
The someone is you, each and every one of you that are listening, and friends that you know that are in a similar circumstance. It's you that will convince the lawmakers. One by one, we can educate people and sway them that everybody is not the monster that they think, because most lawmakers don't even know the breadth of the registry. It's never been it's something that's out of sight and out of mind. They don't think about the registry. They know that, as far as they're concerned, that people on it are really bad. And the only way to dispel that rumor is for you to go meet with a lawmaker. And if you have the ability to say, I am on the registry, and I'm on the registry for this, and watch their eyes glaze over when you tell them that what you did, that was relatively, many of the people are on the registry for relatively minor incidents, like the consensual sex with an underage partner. You say, well, I was 19 and she was 17, and anything under 18 in this state is a felony, and I'm on the registry for that. But we were both in love. They go, huh? You're on the registry for that? Yep, I'm on the registry as a violent child sex offender, and I'm on for life.
Right.
Those are stories that they need to hear.
And you've also said that the stories from, probably more so like on the young children, that says, I miss my dad, would have a lot of impact as well.
They would. The adolescent stories particular, because when you're in single digits, the understanding of a child 10, less than 10 years old is probably minimal. But once they move past that age and they start understanding more and relating to the circumstance their family is in, you can only hide this from your children for so long. And And then at some point they want to know what this means, and you have to explain it to them and the things that they're not allowed to do because of their parent being on the registry. You have to deal with that. And then those stories will be compelling coming from an adolescent that I would like to be able to do these things, but I'm not allowed to. Yep. I'd like to have my parents both at my school play, but they're not allowed to be there.
There's another particular piece, I think it was in the clip that I played, about learning something that they cannot take away. And I've held this philosophy for my entire professional career, that instead of having an employer pay for your training, if it's something you can afford, if you can go buy a series of books and train yourself, they can't ever take that away. And it puts you in a negotiation position where you can say, well, I know this thing and you're not willing to pay for it. I'm not obligated to you because I learned it on my own. Then I can go take my skills elsewhere and get compensated for it, whether that be a bachelor's, master's, certifications, truck driver, forklift driver, fill in however you want to, improve your skill set. Then they can't take it away from you.
I agree that when people say what they're not allowed to do, there are a lot of things that they're allowed to do that they self-impose that they're not allowed to do. You do have some limitations on attending a structural university or college or educational setting, but there are a lot of things where there would be no such barrier if you're doing it on self-study or online. And I like to go back to Apollo 13. I don't want to hear about what this thing was designed to do. I want to hear what it can do.
Yeah,
and I want to hear people talk about what they can do, what options they have available to them. And we understand there are a lot of barriers, but let's focus on what we can do rather than what we're prohibited from doing.
Let's bounce over to the Washington Post. No one should profit off of prisoners trying to stay in touch with their families. I personally know that this is horrible, that how much they charge for phone calls, which has got to be why you would find so many contraband cell phones in prison. But you would possibly end up spending $20 or something to make a 15-minute phone call. I always come back to, I really, really thought that the idea of prison was rehabilitation, but a key component of rehabilitation would be contact with those friends, family, whomever. And there are so many barriers where you have to get approval for who's on your call list before you can make those phone calls. And they do minor background checks on those people. And then they hit you with this huge fee of keeping in touch. It's so, so challenging to then ask someone to say, hey, I'd like to call you once a month. Can you accept a $15, $20 phone call from me? And they're like, no, you're not worth all that.
Well, I think we've talked about this. This is in the federal, in the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Relief, whatever that acronym stands for. But the feds are not charging for phone calls, as I understand it now. Of course, if you're locked down, that limits your ability. But this is provoking some debate about the unreasonable charges for telephones. But I go back to what I've said before. It is a revenue stream for our prisons. I'll give you an example that's a much, much different example. But since I'm in a state where the income tax, the state income tax piggybacks federal, you can end up paying tax on your Social Security benefits. And we're only, 9 or 10 states that do that. And people say, well, why don't you take it off? Well, there's a revenue component that goes with that tax. We are collecting some money that funds part of the state operations from that tax. And then they'll come back and they'll say, well, if we make New Mexico a retirement haven, more people will come and we'll get all that tax revenue. But see, there's one slight flaw with that argument. If all the states are doing it except for 9 or 10 already, people are already set in their older age and they may not come. But even if they do come, if that gush comes, that's off into the future. I have to balance this budget now. So if I pull out $33 billion or whatever that brings in of tax revenue, that is something that I have to replace now, because making the cuts is difficult. Nobody wants to be cut. Now, we're going to be cut because of this pandemic where states are going to be doing some significant cutting. But the same thing goes with a prison or a county jail, which county jails tend to charge more. But this is a revenue stream for the institution, and it's difficult to take away a revenue stream and go back to the taxpayers and say, well, the the phone contract at MDC, which is our local county jail, brought in $2.2 million. We're turning that thing off now. Okay, well, now of our $350 million county budget, where are we going to plug that $2 million of revenue back from to take up for the phone slack? What are we going to cut, or what are we going to increase? What are we going to do for that money?
Couldn't we just lock up fewer people?
Well, we could do that, but that still wouldn't address the issue of the free phone calls. There would still be a revenue stream there that would be going away. If you cut the population in jail from 2,500 to 1,500, clearly there would likely be fewer phone calls, but it's still a revenue stream, right?
Yes, it is.
Well,
I seem to change my position while I was gone because you've committed a crime against the state, and it is in the state's interest that you not commit those in the future, that the state should bear the burden of rehabilitating you and all that. The whole private prison thing and all the private services stuff, there shouldn't be this massive markup on it. If a private company is going to be provided, it's almost make it like a Georgia Power thing where it's a private-public partnership, and they are regulated at to what they can charge. They have to get legislative approval before they do rate hikes and whatnot. And there's some sort of balance set in there to keep prices as low, but then the company can still make money. And I don't think that this is in there, Larry. This is totally, hey, well, these people no one gives a shit about, and we can gouge them. And they're a forgotten group in society, so let's just gouge them. They deserve it.
Well, it's that, but it's the apathy of the population. The go out and campaign, try to sell this politically, that we want to turn off all the revenue streams that come from prisoners, and we want to divert a lot more money out of the general fund to rehabilitative programs, to counseling, and to reintegration. And tell me how that sells for you. You're in a good county. Go out, do that, and tell me how that works.
I'm sure it wouldn't work. But, you know, like you could easily say, just like with people that when they fall down on their luck and they lose their job, well, I don't have any money in savings. Well, you should have thought about before, blah, blah, blah. Well, the state should have thought about that before a global pandemic kicks in and we implement procedures and things so that people can stay in touch, because we've also shut off visitation. Like, they should have thought about this beforehand to have a buffer in their coffers.
Well, I mean, I agree with you that we should not be gouging people for telephone, but I'm giving you the political reality that you've got revenue that flows. And one thing most Americans almost unanimously agree on is that people who are being kept up by the taxpayers should be contributing all they can. And this is one way where they give back, as they pay for the privilege of talking on the telephone and for using the internet they're doing these video visitations now. They're charging for those. We've got to change the mindset of the public in terms of what they want and their corrections. Right now, I don't see us making a massive lurch towards, I mean, if you look at how timid we're being on releasing people, that should tell you that we have not all of a sudden had an epiphany about being soft on people who are incarcerated.
Right.
If you can't get people out of death's way, they're in these institutions that are so grossly overcrowded, they have no way of providing any buffer for them whatsoever.
I don't like it, Larry. Do not like it.
Well, I got an idea. Rather than going out and going to some of your groups on Sunday, go out and spend each Sunday trying to educate. Spend your time at the Macon Mall or whatever it's still where there's still people, and talk about and try to inform people about the misguided nature of our correctional system in the United States and win them over one at a time.
I will start working on that for sure, and I will wear something of a bomb suit because I'm sure people are going to throw things at me. We have a trio of articles talking about this particular one. And this particular one is from CNS News. It says, California DA calls out court for using COVID-19 to justify releasing 7 convicted high-risk sex offenders. I wanted to get an audio clip that someone shared and had trouble actually getting the little bit of a clip. But even if you take just the little clip of the DA saying it, and I tried really hard to figure out how I could say I've taken to take it out of context, and I don't want to, but he said, sex offenders cannot be rehabilitated, and they need to be monitored. And I don't know if he said for life after that, but he said there's even a quote in this particular article. It says, yeah, I did call out the court for releasing 7 convicted high-risk sex offenders who are failing to report for parole. Oh, never. Does it say it? No, it doesn't have a quote in the article then where he said it. But he said they can't be rehabilitated.
Well, he's better than that. He says now the district, Orange County district attorney, is named Todd Spitzer, and he was on Fox and Friends. Now, does that tell you anything? That he's on that's a national show, so he's applying nationwide pressure to judges in Orange County that have released some offenders for their safety, but he says that they were charged with cutting off their GPS monitors and otherwise tampering. Now, in all likelihood, they probably weren't cutting. They lost signal. The GPS loses contact. And I'm not saying that no one cut them, but I'm sure that very few people have cut their those. But he's lambasting the judge. He's getting public opinion all excited. These people shouldn't be released to the street. They should be locked up in our jail, he told Fox and Friends. And he says that they can't be rehabilitated. And this is what I was just describing previously. This is where the public is. He's saying this because the public, they're loving this. who do you think has better public support right now? The judge who let these people out in a compassionate way, or Spitzer? If you took a poll to Orange County, who do you think would be ahead?
I would be willing to bet he is.
So that is the whole point.
And here is the quote. It says, I'm here to tell you sex offenders cannot be rehabilitated. And when they're trying to avoid detection, like they are here in Orange County, they need to be locked up and we need to protect the public. And if you see a picture, forgive the seven individuals' pictures. They are very scraggly looking individuals that you would probably be afraid of to encounter on the street.
So, well, and then toward the end of the article, he says, what's happening, though, is that I think it's been a ruse on the American public about freeing our jails, and there's actually been an advancement of a social policy to not incarcerate. So
throw all the tomatoes at me. Do you think there has any coincidence there that he's on Fox News saying that?
Don't think there's any coincidence at all.
All right, so before I get angry about that particular one, over at The Appeal, well, I'll get angry about this one. Tennessee set to execute intellectually disabled black men in killing of white women, even though innocence questions persist. This happened a long time ago, and the person, like, his girlfriend lived across the hall, and he apparently, like, was going over to her house and found the door open, goes in to attempt to help and to see what was up. Maybe he heard a scuffle or something like that, heard some crying maybe, and goes in to help, ends up with like blood on his hands and all stuff. And then they prosecuted him and got convicted, and there's a execution coming halfway soon. But there's a lot of questions about how the case was developed and the guilty verdict and all this stuff. These things are terrible, Larry.
So, yeah, well, the part that puzzled me a little bit is, I guess the pulling the knife out, if a person's dead, there's no need to. But if they're not dead, I've always heard that you could do more damage. But if you're intellectually challenged, I guess that would explain why you wouldn't necessarily comprehend that. But pulling the knife out was what he did that got the blood on him in his version of the events.
Yep.
You've stumbled in situations like this with knives and people before. What is your reaction?
Oh,
do you
course.
Leave the knife?
Yes. All the time. Almost daily, Larry.
Have you removed the knife when you've run into this in the past?
This is one of the things in the quote-unquote treatment programs that they provide, that if you are encountering a single child and they are crying for help, you should probably go the other way lest someone accuse you of doing something that you did not do. I find that to be incredibly inhumane. But were I to come up on someone that had a knife in them, I would certainly not pull it out. But I do know that already, because the knife could be blocking the artery from them bleeding out. But if you are intellectually disabled, I don't think the article said, is he 10 points below average? Is he 50 points below average? Doesn't say how disabled he is. And not that I have any level of expertise to make that decision, but maybe the person just doesn't know. There are all kinds of people that don't know all kinds of quote unquote common sense things too.
Absolutely. And executing a person in this pandemic makes it very difficult with the distancing orders to have the people there to witness it. There's a process. An execution is a complicated thing.
Yeah.
And I learned that when we had our last execution. I'm trying to remember what year it was. A very long time ago. We had in this state the last execution. I think it was maybe about 2000, so at least 20 years ago, maybe even a little bit before 2000, but somewhere in that range. And those who want to bring the death penalty back, they admitted that they would have to go be trained on how to do an execution, to go through all the processes of gearing up, preparing the inmate, preparing the families, preparing the witnesses, and you can't do all that in the middle of this pandemic because you don't want those people together in the execution room and the visitation room, the viewing room.
Yes, I understand. So do you think that this gains any traction? I don't think our Supreme Court does a whole lot with these kinds of cases very often.
If he's down to nothing but the federal court, his chances are very slim. He's going to need something to happen within the state of Tennessee. But the U.S. Supreme Court has taken a hands-off posture largely on most executions. The Supreme Court justice that's assigned to that circuit has the power to issue a stay. But the experience is that the full court convenes and dissolves the stay. So they're pointless to issue stays anymore. So that's one of those things where you call the circuit judge that presides over that circuit. They say it's not going to do any good. If I give you a stay, they're going to dissolve it within a few days.
Gotcha. Then we have an article from The Hill. Welcome back to COVID articles. 96% of inmates in 4 state prisons who tested positive for coronavirus were asymptomatic. So what does asymptomatic mean, Larry?
Well, it means that they weren't displaying any of the expected symptoms that we've been told to look out for. But I'm not so sure about that number, because if they're going to isolate you, put you in the hole, and that's prison jargon for not a nice place to be, they're going to put you in seg. I would suspect a lot of people that have symptoms are doing everything they can to hide those, disguise those symptoms, wouldn't you?
Yes, totally. Because you would be miserable. It is miserable in isolation.
So I'm a little dubious about the numbers.
You don't think the 96 is accurate?
It's hard for me to believe that would be realistic. That 96 of them were asymptomatic.
That would also imply that they all got tested.
But if that's the case, then we've got an awful lot of people that are running around that are positive out in the population.
I would agree with that too. And I mean, that's one of the big challenges in the United States is we haven't had anywhere near enough tests compared to, I think South Korea is reporting single digit numbers of new cases, and we detected it in country, as far as I know, unless the information has changed. Both us and South Korea detected it in country on the same day. And they're down to single digits across their country of, I think, 100 million people in South Korea. Maybe it's 80 million people in South Korea. So I realize it's not geographically similar, and population, it's not terribly similar. It's kind of sort of similar, but they have enough tests and a different government structure that they can implement testing better or something like that. Anyway, we don't have enough tests, so I don't know how they would get 96% of the prisoners to be tested.
That's a puzzle, because most of what I'm hearing at the institutions is that no one can get a test. Very difficult to get a test.
But if you're in a room with 80 people and one person has it, you could probably just, I don't think it would be very much of a leap, Larry, to go, they all have it in that dorm. I don't think that would be that much of a stretch.
Very likely. Thoughts? Very likely.
Let's see. Where do we have to go next? That was The Hill. Then WBUR in Boston. We have an article that says Massachusetts, I think you call it Taxachusetts, High Court urges governor to use his powers to release prisoners because of COVID-19. Why would we release people based on COVID-19?
The reason why I put this in here is because the court stood down and said we're not going to usurp the power. The executive has an enormous amount of power to regulate the population of prison. They have levers and tools at their disposal. And those who believe that they don't want judges legislating from the bench, they should be as happy as a lark with this decision, because this is the Supreme Judicial Court, which is the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts, saying that we are not going to invent a law. There's already processes. There's already laws on the books to cut down the prison population. Governor Baker, you have those powers. You have those levers. If you want to reduce the prison population, do so. And wouldn't that make
gonna, he's gonna hold that account though? They're gonna hold him accountable for that come the next election.
Well, we'll see if they do or not. But I mean, that is the decision you would expect and want from a court that's not going to be legislating from the bench, which most conservatives decry legislating from the bench.
We don't want them legislating from the bench, do we?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you're conservative, you certainly don't. Now, the truth is we do want, everybody wants the judges to legislate from the bench when it's something they're for, is they can't get through the regular process. Everybody wants the courts to legislate from the bench. That's why everybody files stuff in court.
Yeah.
But that's the big mantra of the conservatives. We don't want, well, I want the president to appoint people who ain't going to do no legislating from the bench. I want them just to interpret the law. And that's what this court did.
And that's what Gundy is.
That's exactly right. For those of you who don't remember Gundy, that was the U.S. Supreme Court decision that interpreted the Attorney General's delegation, the Congress delegated to the Attorney General how to implement the Adam Walsh Act.
Right.
We're missing an article in here. We're going to talk about hypocrisy tonight, weren't we?
And which hypocrisy were we going to talk about? Was this about a particular vice presidential presidential nomination?
Yes, we're going to talk about a little bit of hypocrisy. So we need to have Lester Maddox.
I can get that ready, but you never shared an article which one you wanted to talk to me about while I did.
I did send you one on the normal back channels we use. Describing what Kavanaugh had been accused of, and then we talked about what Biden's been accused of, and so yeah, I want to. But just in generalities, we don't have to talk about an article. We can just talk about about hypocrisy.
See, you tell me that it's not there, but lo and behold, it is now there.
Mm-hmm.
The magic of the internet has made it possible, Larry.
So,
tell me what's up with comparing Brett Kavanaugh to Joe Biden.
Well, I'm struggling with this. I remember talking about the governor of New Mexico some few episodes back being accused of sexual misconduct, and she did not resign from office. And I could have sworn we've had, who was the senator from Minnesota?
That would be Al Franken.
Al Franken, right? I thought that if an allegation is made that under the standards that the Me Too movement have universally adopted, is that it's the seriousness of the allegations, and that to even dare to question the allegations is to re-victimize the victim who finally, after all these years and sometimes decades, has had the courage to come forward. And I'm just wondering why that former Vice President Biden is able to deflect these allegations and just so cruelly and heartlessly say that they're not true. And he says he doesn't remember it. Now, if something didn't happen, you would have a very difficult time remembering something that didn't happen. I would agree that if someone says, I don't remember it, if it didn't happen, of course, you wouldn't remember it. But I'm trying to understand the Me Too standards, because it seems like with Kavanaugh, now we had a young man we were talking about in high school and college, who was accused of, well, I mean, there's no way to describe it other than rape. And
correct.
Then we have a sitting United States senator who was accused in 1993. Now, the accusation wasn't made official with the police, as it wasn't with Blasey Ford, with Kavanaugh. But so we're talking about a person who's much more mature than a high school or a college student. Not that that justifies misbehavior, but we have a sitting United States senator who had at that time chaired the Senate Judiciary Committee, who had overseen the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, had heard all of the stuff with Anita Hill, and this person, if these allegations were true, did some pretty gross things to this staffer. And I'm just wondering why that it's okay. And I don't see the difference, because if anything, a senator would be held to a higher standard of conduct than a college or a high school frat boy, or there's not any fraternities in high school, but a high school kid or a college frat boy. And I'm just puzzled at the apologist and the people who now all of a sudden they don't have any issue with these allegations. And I thought that for what the whole thing was about, the seriousness of the allegation disqualify a person from public life.
And believe the woman.
That's what I'm trying. And I would like for someone really sincerely to come on the podcast and explain to me what I'm missing, because clearly I'm missing something here. And the Me Too movement, if any of you are listening, contact the show and we will try to get you on. But I want to know what the difference is. We had the thing with Roy Moore. We're talking about something. Kavanaugh's was in the 80s. Roy Moore's was in the 70s. And we've got a United States senator in the 90s where there's at least as much evidence as there was in those allegations, particularly with Kavanaugh. Apparently, there was a call from her mother to the Larry King show saying that a prominent United States senator had done these inappropriate things.
And to highlight some distinctions, though. So Roy Moore was, as I understand the story, he was, I think, in his 30s. He was an ADA, maybe, assistant DA, and a consensual dating relationship with, I think, maybe a 15-year-old. But the family was in on it. They were, like, going out to barbecues and whatnot. But you just introduced the quote-unquote oogie factor, I guess. Kavanaugh was alleged to have had sex with, I think, a passed out drunk girl at the time, woman now, obviously. Al Franken, the only thing that I know that he did, there was a picture where he had his hands out, like in front of. I'm not justifying that it was an okay thing to do, but it's like he didn't do what Kavanaugh was alleged to have done. And it still seems to be farther back than what Biden is being alleged to have done, but not to the degree that Kavanaugh was. And everyone blew off the whole Kavanaugh thing. Not everyone, but he obviously got voted in as a Supreme Court nominee. But Franken, for doing something as a prank, stupid, inappropriate, fill in all those words, it's fine. But forced out.
Well, that's
so
what
I'm with you on the confusion. I'm with you 100%.
And I want to get this down so I can understand it and explain it to people. Now, Franken was supposedly a liberal.
Yes.
But here we've got a liberal moderate candidate for president, and I don't hear a lot from the Me Too movement, and I'm just trying to figure out, there's got to be something that I'm missing that makes this different, and I need someone to help us with that.
All right. So if you want to, hey, Larry, how could they contact the program if they wanted to reach out to us?
Well, they would do one of the many, many options we have. The best way, of course, is to call us. That way, we can play what you say. That would be 747-227-4477. But if you don't like speaking, you can send us an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
You know what I'm going to do, Larry? I'm going to do this impromptu. We received a voicemail just as we started recording.
We did.
Do you want me to play it? We did. I can play it. It's not going to be edited, and I might have to cut it.
Well, let's see what we have.
Let's see if I can make this work on the fly.
Hi, Andy and Larry. This is Rob in Pennsylvania. Keep up the good work, guys. You're doing a great job. I enjoy listening every week, and I am a supporter, patron. My question is in reference to the registries, and you hear it floating around that the numbers are almost up to 1 million in the country of people on the registries. But my question is how accurate is that? Does that include people who aren't actually listed publicly? Like, for instance, in New York State, level ones are not publicly listed on the website. Does that, almost 1 million, would that include those people, or is that only based on public accessible information? And also, does that take into consideration people that are maybe registered in two different states? Like, for instance, they visited in Florida, so they're on for life and in their own home state. So that's my question. Just wondering how accurate that number is. Thanks, guys. Keep up the great work. Enjoy listening every week, and FYP.
I think that's an excellent question, and well done, Rob in Pennsylvania.
I think it was a great question as well. I do not believe the number is accurate at all. And so the first component of the question about the the people who are not public. My understanding is that it only includes the people who are public. Now, that is the overwhelming majority of registrants across the country. But he is correct. There are states where there's a segment or slice. It could be juveniles. It could be juveniles only, or it could be juveniles and level ones. And there's a segment and slice of the population that are not in that count, in my experience. The other component of it is that there are dual registrations, and there are people who have deceased. And if you simply go to the registry website, if that's what the compilers are doing, you would have dual registrations, a person who's left a state and then they're carried in both states, or they're legitimately connected to two states because of the proximity to a border and they're traveling back and forth and they're registering in two states. And I believe that there's a lot of duplication of that. So I'm not convinced it is a million, but I'm convinced it's a significant number of people, well over a half million, and probably closer to 750,000 easily. And then there's some who are actually on the list that are incarcerated. They've been in the public and they've been returned to prison, or in some instances they were put on the public list just because they were sentenced for a sexual offense. A few states do that. They go ahead and list them upon conviction on the registry, and then they show them the list that they're in a prison in custody. But it's a huge number of people.
Hey, Brian in Louisiana says, since NCMEC stopped counting, at least publicly, who knows anymore? That's the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Yes. What did
they
he say?
Stopped counting? He said they stopped counting, at least publicly. I wasn't aware of that. That's the only reason I bring it up.
So, well, they last time I looked, they still have a website that tells how many offenders are on each state's registry as of a certain date.
How many people do you think are dual registered, and do places like where they don't publicly register tier ones, does NCMEC and others, would Patch and Offender Watch, would they still have those numbers?
I don't believe they do. I believe you'd have to do a public records request from each state of what their total number of people registered are. And I don't believe they do that, but I can't be absolutely positive. I believe that they just simply use the public available information. And if you were to, our state doesn't have everyone on the website. It's not a level system. It's a particular group of offenses that are not listed. And then no juveniles are listed. But to get the total for New Mexico, you would have to contact the Department of Public Safety and ask them the total number of people that are registered, and the website would have a lesser number. But the dual registrations and the ones who are deceased, that's where the big offsets are, because you've got people who started the registry journey in Florida and they went to another state, and Florida says, we keep your picture and we keep your registration information. We show you living out of state. So that creates a registry record twice for that person. And then you have people who dutifully go to Florida, and they don't want to be in the state more than 72 hours or whatever it is. So on those, they go register, and then they find themselves listed on both the Florida and their home state registry. They find themselves, the same thing happens in Nevada. So there's duplications for sure. So it's hard to know what the accurate number is.
And I've just added an article to the show notes with a source talking about why did they delete their map of registered SOs in the United States. No idea the veracity of the article at all, but I am providing you people with a source.
And I just misspoke about the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I was thinking of the Class Foundation. They're the ones who had a map of the United States with a list of each state's total. And I haven't gone to that foundation website in a long time, but they used to have a total, but it wasn't Center for Missing Exploited Children.
Okay. And something else to bring up that Rob in Pennsylvania is a Patreon supporter. Larry, what is the best way to support this podcast?
Well, if you're a patron, go immediately log in and double your patron donation.
We know that everyone just got a $1,200 check, right?
Right. Well, why not give us what would be a fair
all
cut?
Of it? All?
I don't know.
All
gonna...
of it, including your kid.
the $500 dependent
absolutely.
Well?
All of them. And if you got one for your dog, send that one too.
So registrymatters.co.
That's where the website is. Patreon.com/registrymatters is the other, the place for the Patreon part.
So somebody did a CO. I don't know who did that, but
it was me, and I still don't know why.
Maybe you were smoking that wacky weed when you did that.
That could possibly be true, but hopefully my handlers aren't hearing about that. That way I don't get in trouble for smoking the wacky weed. I would also like to add, hey, look, we have a YouTube channel. You can friend us, like us, whatever, subscribe to us there. Help us get our numbers up. We're on Twitter, and I post there at least monthly. At least monthly. But you could become a follower there, and that would also be helpful. You can like and subscribe and write a review for us at all of the places where you subscribe to podcasts. And all those things would be helpful for us to help other people find us. Larry, is there anything else that we need to cover that we've missed that we need to chime in on before you roast and melt?
Well, it has continued to climb in here. I think we're about 82 now, but it's not that bad. No, I think we've had a reasonably short, concise podcast tonight.
Yes, and we did record early. Brian in Louisiana said, hey, and I was all ready for a 6 central time start, and he catches the end. Yes, but that's because it's roasting hot in Larry's recording location, and wanted to get things knocked out before he melts.
And I just love my picture. That is just so awesome.
I'm glad that you like it. And if you want to find that picture, I don't know if I'm going to publish this to YouTube or not. But otherwise, come check out the live stream. If you want to, there's a link in the show notes, and you can come in and watch my my large teeth record the podcast and a picture of Larry at his ripe young age of 300, 250, somewhere around there.
Well, all righty, Andy.
Have a great night, Larry, and I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Good night. Bye.